Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Lingraphica Radio. We're excited to kick off our ASHA 2015 Blog Talk Radio series by discussing each of our presentations at ASHA this year. We've done a lot of research lately and want to share it with all the SLPs, not just those who can make it to ASHA in Denver, but those with a computer who can turn it on and hit play and listen to each of our shows. It's my great pleasure this time to welcome Dr. Richard Steele, Chief Scientist at Lingraphica, who's going to explain to us and talk about his paper that he'll be presenting entitled Combining Therapy and Online Exercises to Improve Outcomes, Increase Engagement at an LPAA Aphasia Center. Welcome, Dr. Steele.
Hello. It's good to be here.
And I recall back in the spring we had you on with a young lady talking about LPAA as well. Can you tell our audience what that means? What is LPAA? And what does it look like for an adult with aphasia?
Right. Well, LPAA stands for Life Participation Approach to Aphasia. And the title itself gives important clues to how to think about it. First off, it's an approach to helping people with aphasia and to the people who are living with aphasia. It's not a specific program, but it generally is a sort of a mindset which focuses on the participation of the person with aphasia in their own lives as an active agent, an effective agent, somebody who will be fulfilled. And in doing the study that we're going to be presenting, I was privileged to work with the people at the Snyder Center for Aphasia Life Enhancement, whose acronym is SCALE, S-C-A-L-E. And there, the founder there is Denise McCall, and it is one of the premier centers in the United States that embodies an LPAA sort of approach to aphasia. They have a very, very rich program. A couple of times a week, people gather together. They have a large number of people from around. They're located in Baltimore, and they have people who come in from the city and from this areas around the city a couple of days a week. And they have various classes and various activities that are organized, and these range from therapy sessions to games and card sessions where they play games and cards to other sessions where they cover what's new in the news, or they talk about hobbies such as photography or gardening and so on. And so that's a very wide range of topics. That one of the important principles in an LPAA program, such as the SCALE program, is that in every one of them, they look to enrich the experience for the person with aphasia, but also to provide therapeutic benefit, because, of course, the people with aphasia, these speech, language, communication disorders, their improvement is a life journey. They can continue to improve as long as they continue to work. And so this is a combined sort of like therapy on the one hand and engagement with activities in their own life. And in working with them, we were able basically then to look at enriching this very, very extensive program that they already have with teletherapy and online exercises.
Now, I know that the Snyder Center for Aphasia Life Enhancement in Baltimore, run by Denise, is very focused on technology. So in this life participation approach, How does teletherapy, for instance, and online therapy factor into their treatment?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're absolutely correct that Denise's program at the SCALE in Baltimore is one of those that has the most experience in working with advanced technologies. It's important to understand, of course, that technology is only one aspect, and it's not the central aspect. The approach, the LPA philosophy holds that you draw on whatever it is that works, and where technology will deliver particular benefits, you draw on that, and where other types of supported communication will, you draw on that, where activity and act of hands-on engagement will, you draw on that, and so on. But in the case of the study that we were doing, what we were doing was looking at enriching the kind of program that these people would have available, the participants in the SCALE program, by making offerings available on days when the SCALE program did not meet. The people would attend their sessions on Mondays and Wednesdays, but during the other days of the week, SCALE was not in operation, and it was during those times that they could do such things as engage in teletherapeutic sessions with a teleclinician that we made available, and or whenever they wanted, they could go online and they could use exercises that were available to them and had been set up in a therapeutic program by that teleclinician, and they could engage in those as much as they want, whenever they wanted. And again, it's important to emphasize that this was done at their preference. So when they wanted to go out and do gardening, they would go out and do gardening. When they wanted to engage in conversation with others, they would do that. When they wanted to work with technology, that was available as well.
Okay. So how does using these more technological therapy options differ from the traditional pen and paper and other traditional techniques?
Well, there are a lot of ways, and some of these we ourselves are still learning about. But the most obvious one is that these materials can be made available on demand. They can be made available and served up in adaptive programs so that the program itself can observe how a person is doing with the particular materials, and if there are areas where a person is encountering particular difficulties, then supplementary materials could be made available to them where they're making good progress, then perhaps it would be appropriate to either up the level of challenge or perhaps introduce complementary kinds of exercises. Another of the ways that this can differ is that in working with these online materials, we have a record, a historical record of how people have done, and we can go back retrospectively, and we can look at that, and we can see, oh, here are the areas where they've made particular benefits, here are areas where they still have some opportunities, use that to help direct both the teletherapy that would be delivered by the teleclinician and then to massage the materials that are delivered up. Then there's the very direct sort of difference between paper and pen, you know, pen and paper, that between those and the sorts of interactive, multimodal, highly stimulating materials that can be made available using high technology. So, for example, if you have a word which is written on a piece of paper, you're able to look at the spelling of the word and you can practice writing it and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't necessarily hear how the word is spoken. Whereas in using the materials that we make available, for example, if you're working on a particular word, you can have the spelling of the word displayed, but when you click on it, it can respond in a way which actually heightens your ability to see the and hear and process the particular materials. We can provide multimodal stimulation and input. We can illustrate the meaning of a particular word, like a verb, with an animation which shows a person, if the verb is drink, we can show a person drinking a glass of water, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things set it aside. It makes it available in a way which can be particularly stimulating and can be made personalizable for the individual.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you're not ruling out the use of the traditional therapy solutions either, right?
Absolutely.
You're looking at this as additive.
Yeah, absolutely. I do return to what I wanted, the point that I made earlier, which is that in the this approach to aphasia in general, you draw on what works, you know, in the situation for the particular purposes, what is effective. Sometimes that is pencil and paper. Those are extremely valuable technologies. But sometimes it'll be, you know, live interaction via in a teletherapeutic session, and sometimes it'll be materials that are you're working with on a computer screen that you're interacting with in particularly stimulating ways.
Right. So, how would a speech language pathologist use the data that derives from the teletherapy and online therapy sessions?
Well, there are a lot of different ways, and it depends on how the particular speech pathologist is engaging with the particular client. So there's a whole wide range of ways that speech pathologists and clients could work together. Sometimes there may be a formal therapeutic set of sessions that are going on, and in those cases, for example, the teleclinician who was involved in this particular study, before she would start up a teletherapeutic session with one of the clients, she would go back and review what that client had done, which is available to her, and she could see what they had been working on and with what success and where there were difficulties, and use that then to inform and plan out how she wants to approach the teletherapy session which is upcoming. So that would be the context of an ongoing set of formal therapeutic sessions that are being delivered. Sometimes people have a relationship which is not so formal. That can be useful and valuable as well. Perhaps they have worked with a particular teletherapist and they're just interested in getting some ideas or some general guidance, some thoughts about materials that might be useful to work with. And in those cases, we make available, for example, on our website, we have reference sheets that show particular, benefit areas to people with communicative disorders who have used our various types of materials. And so those, a speech pathologist in a situation like that could simply review those particular materials and say, oh, yeah, my person is interested in working on, for example, better listening, better, auditory verbal comprehension. And the sheets that we have could provide suggestions for materials that would be useful to recommend to that person to use.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So with that data and with all the work that Lingraphica and you have been doing in teletherapy and online therapy and this life participation approach, what is the most interesting finding you've discovered so far?
Okay, so there are many, many, many interesting findings, it is a voyage of discovery in a positive sense. I mean, these materials are very powerful, and when they're well matched with a person and the person's goals and interests and so on, we get some very, very striking results. So some of the findings, specific findings, first one I would say that was very nice to be able to document was that in all of the areas, the broad areas that are of importance, of identified importance within the life participation approach to aphasia, we showed that there are benefits, important benefits, often large and highly statistically significant benefits, to be after working with our material. So to give a specific example, there's a particular framework for where people with aphasia have made particular gains. It's called AFROM, the framework for outcome measurements in aphasia. And they identify four broad areas that you want to have in mind. So the first one is, and the most obvious one would be sort of like language and speech language communication performance, just sort of, for example, the ability to recall words, the ability to put words together into sentences, the ability to use those to communicate some sort of question or some sort of statement or an expression of emotion, whatever it is that is of importance to the person. So that's the first one, their language performance. But beyond that, every bit as important, all of these are important, is their actual participation in communicative situations. Because you could imagine somebody who's able to ask a question, but if they choose not to, they're not going to be participating well. So what we're interested in is we're interested in seeing not only that a person is able to form sentences and questions and so on and use them for communicative purposes, but that they actually do, and that they do that in a way which is effective for their purposes in that particular context. Another of the areas which is very important is the area of sort of personal identity, their feelings, their attitudes about themselves, where they feel that they have made gains, where they feel that there are things that are of importance to them that they're now able to do that they weren't able to do better. And then the fourth area is in the sort of world itself, the environment in which the communication takes place. So how do we improve or modify or massage the environment in such a way as to enhance the likelihood that a person is going to be communicatively successful when they try to get something across to somebody else? And some of the in our study, one of the things that we did was we used familiar, standardized, valid and reliable assessment instruments where they're available, and they're available in many of these domains. And we assessed these people before they began working with our materials at the beginning of the study and then after the completion of the study. And this allows us to do what are called outcome analyses, to see where there have been changes and how large those changes are and whether people have benefited from them and with what degree of probability we just got lucky, or on the other hand, with what degree of probability we can say this is most likely the result of the work that they did. And we showed that in all of those four areas, the language area, the personal and identity area, the participation, and in the communicative environment and being able to sort of like massage it for their own purposes, that we got significant benefits where we did these kinds of outcome analyses. And one of the most, just so you asked about surprising, I'll give you a concrete example of one which surprised me, simply because I didn't exactly expect it, but it was nice to see. And that was that there's, in terms of their attitudes about themselves and their feelings, their identity, there's a particular instrument which is called the Communication Confidence Rating Scale for aphasia. It was produced by some researchers at the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago. Very useful tool, and assesses. It allows a person to basically to do ratings of their own sense of their level of confidence in doing this thing or that thing or the other thing. And so we administered these questions from the Communication Confidence Rating Scale before and after the test. And one of the questions had to do with how confident are you that you, you know, can handle communications about your own finances. And there was a very large and very substantial, statistically significant rise in people's feelings in that area. Now, the thing that made it surprising to me was that none of the particular materials that we worked on targeted that as an area specifically. We had we hadn't deliberately set it up such that people would be working with materials that deal with bank transactions or mortgages or the vocabulary of financial transactions or anything of that sort. Nothing like that. Nonetheless, people communicated back to us that they felt that they were considerably more confident when they had came to dealing with their own personal finances after this doing this work. Now, that was surprising to me simply because we hadn't provided them with any materials that you could specifically point to and say, well, this would be what we would expect would deliver that result.
Right, so it's really fascinating that they would go that granular and say, yeah, I'm confident with that. I mean, which is such an important part of one's life and feelings of independence in the world, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and it deals also, that's why this one falls into that area of their personal identity, their sense of self, because they now, these people who have, you know, this much greater level of confidence in their the ability to deal with their own finances, they will be viewing themselves as active, effective, independent, you know, autonomous agents on their own behalf in an area which is of great importance in our culture and in our society. And it's, you know, very nice to see that. I'll give you one just as a sort of comparison. There was one area where their level of confidence barely budged. There was a very, very small increase, but it wasn't statistically significant and it was really, really minuscule. And that was in their ability to follow sports on TV and on the radio. And so when you think about that, you sort of then wonder, okay, so why might this be the case? And we don't have an answer to that question. I mean, that would be but I have a hypothesis that would be a testable hypothesis. And my guess is that, for example, somebody who is very, you know, a great fan of football, for example. Okay, that is likely to be a person who, before they, you know, had the onset of their communication disorders, they, you know, had this great love of that sport beforehand. They knew the rules. Perhaps they played it themselves. They had been following the people. They knew the personal styles of the individual players and so on. And so when they watch a football game on TV, there's really not much room for improvement. They're going to be real, real good at that to begin with. And that's what we really showed, was that their confidence level was about 95% beforehand, and it moved up to about 96% afterwards. But it's just that they're real good to begin with. So, as I say, that's not proof of anything. It's a hypothesis for later testing. But I think it makes a very interesting contrast with this finding from the very same assessment instrument on their improved confidence in dealing with financial matters.
Now, you mentioned the confidence measure and a couple other measurements that you were doing. That's part of ASHA's NOMS measurement system, right? National Outcomes Measurement System.
It's related to that. Now, ASHA, for the NOMS system, ASHA has developed its own set of specific areas to be assessed and its own set of criteria for doing the assessment. So it's a related kind of thing, but if you're going to be doing, in fact, actually in our study, the NOMS assessments were also conducted. So we used both the NOMS as one of the assessment instruments. We also used the CCRSA, the Communication Confidence Rating Scale for aphasia. And we used the Western Aphasia Battery and a number of other instruments as well, communicative effectiveness and index and so on.
So extensive measurement went on.
Yes, Yes. We assessed people on about 6 different dimensions, which covered all 4 of these areas from the AFROM, the framework for outcomes measurement in aphasia. And as I say, we showed it important. The outcomes were essentially all positive, and for the most part, they were both, you know, impressively large and statistically significant.
Okay. Well, Dr. Steele, I won't keep you any longer. You've given us a great deal of time today, and I appreciate it. I want to tell those attending ASHA this year, ASHA 2015, mm-hmm. that if you're there, please make time and check out the full presentation with Dr. Richard Steele on Saturday, November 14th at 8:30 a.m. in room 113 at the Colorado Convention Center. I'm sure it's going to be great because, as you can tell just from this radio show, he's a pleasure to listen to and even more of a pleasure in person. Dr. Steele, thank you again.
Thanks again, Steve. I really appreciate it. Thanks for the interview.
Absolutely. And also, everyone, please check out ASHA's booth. Please check out Lingraphica's booth at the ASHA show. That's booth number 332. And if you're not going, you can keep up with everything that's going on at aphasia.com and, of course, Facebook, Twitter, and all sorts of other social media that we'll be actively working on before, during, and after ASHA. Thanks again, Dr. Steele. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.